Joe, how you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Well, lots to talk about this week, some topical current matters, and we'll get on to see if we get to our main topic. First, the what happened this week, the apparently this legislation had been percolating for more than a year. Obviously, the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, it was passed by the House 321 to 90 or 320 to 91. I forget which
Yeah.
way. Overwhelmingly passes the House, bipartisan support, so you know it's a good idea, right? This is probably one of the most vulgar pieces of pandering legislation I've seen in a long time. That's saying a lot, really. This bill seeks to, I guess, penalize and effectively ban anti-Semitism without really defining it. Worse than that, it relies on the IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Association's working definition of
Well, there's an
anti-Semitism.
objective group that'll give you a real dose of reality.
So if to find out what you're saying is kosher, if you will, you have to get the permission of rabbis. I think they're based in New York or something. So we basically it's always New York. The Jews in New York have to approve what we're saying, what we're thinking. This bill, the where was yeah, it voted on Wednesday, overwhelmingly passed a bill that conflates the criticism of the modern state of Israel with anti-Semitism. And mandates the definition to be used, the IHRA definition to be used by the Department of Education when enforcing federal anti-discrimination laws. So it has real teeth if it passes. Obviously, it has to go to the Senate and signed by Joe Biden. All things being equal, it probably will pass if there's any indication. I mean, I think Chuckie Schumer is saying he'll bring it to the floor, that sort of thing. Chuckie Schumer, the Shomer or soldier, self-described Shomer or advocate or defender of Israel. He's a U.S. senator from New York. Who really represents Tel Aviv and Jerusalem? I mean, this is done, of course, in the context of all these protests to the Israeli American ethnic cleansing operation in Gaza that's been going on, I think, in earnest since October 7th. It's been going on since 1947, really. But the response to the Hamas raid, and I think the death toll is among the Palestinians is above 40,000 at least. Some say that's a gross undercount, given that so many are dying and no one's keeping track of it. And it's clearly that the Israelis are trying to orchestrate an ethnic cleansing or final solution, if you will, of the PQ, the Palestinian question. At the same time, I think it came out this week that the Biden administration is working on plans to bring in millions, if not of or at least 2 million. That's pretty much it of the Palestinians in Gaza into the United States and under a refugee program. It's interesting because to be a refugee, you have to be fleeing some sort of tyranny or oppression. So are they admitting that the Palestinians are being terrorized and oppressed by the Israelis?
Yeah, and
You know.
remember, we had actually just when after, immediately after October 7th, we discussed what the future for the Palestinians was going to be, and we agreed that they would just drive the Palestinians south to the border, and then at that point they would squeeze them off into different refugee camps. And this is what's happened. This was the plan all along. This was why the false flag on October 7th was perpetrated. It was to create the pretext so they could genocide the population and then drive the remainder of them out, creating Eretz Israel. And has been the plan since 1840, when Palmerston declared that this was now the time for the Jews to return to the Holy Land. And Freemason organized the project for the first 50 years, at which point they handed it over to Jewish employees of the project. But one only has to read the letters that the second wave of Zionists, the Jewish Zionists, Golda Meir, Menachem Begin, David Ben-Gurion, exchanged among themselves, which has been adroitly assembled by Nir Mersala into his book, The Expulsion of the Palestinians, to see that the plan was always what we're experiencing today. It was always that. They were always intending to create a Jewish-only state and to basically drive out all any other ethnicity, specifically the Palestinians. And they were perfectly willing to use lying and violence to achieve this. So now you get to this moment, and what can one say other than it's been, you know, over 100 years of moral nihilism, and they have just always created some kind of weak pretext for why they are fighting back against, you know, the irrational and kind of failing to be a good neighbor to Palestinians, when this has always been sophistry. It's always been, from the day one, from 1840 to the present moment, the goal was to drive out the Palestinians and create a Jewish, which is to say a religious state in what was Palestine.
Yeah, this law, again, relies on the IHRA's definition, working definition of anti-Semitism. And it's very problematic, because if you read the working definition, it's pretty much labels any criticism or equal treatment of Jews as anti-Semitic, meaning holding them accountable or roughly to the same rules we hold everybody else. Criticism of a Jew is anti-Semitism. Accusing a Jew or Jews of having a greater loyalty to Israel than their host country or societies is anti-Semitism, although that is a basic tenet of Zionism. It goes back to Theodor Herzl, that all Jews are primarily citizens of Israel, which is the diaspora. And of course, once the Jewish state's created, they have loyalty to the Jewish state, not to their host countries, although they can use those host countries to support, to create, and then also support the continuance and expansion of that Jewish state. So they can plant their feet in both countries and, you know, exploit that situation, that dual loyalty ambiguity. At the same time, use the guilt of anti-Semitism to ward off or any criticism, you know, deserved or undeserved. So again, it's one of the things I thought was funny is one of the elements of anti-Semitism, according to the IHRA, is applying double standards by requiring of it a behavior not expected or demanded of any other democratic nation. Well, there we have projection at play here, because they do exactly that to all their other host societies.
Right. And also, isn't the invert first true then? I mean, can't we then say, well, we need to apply the same standards to you that we do to all other nations?
Yes, basically, it's applying the same standards to Jews as anti-Semitism, because it violates the tenets of the Talmud. One of the things they're calling it, the anti-New Testament bill, because, of course, one of the planks or points in the working definition of anti-Semitism is claiming the Jews killed Jesus Christ, or this is like a considered a blood libel. Well, the New Testament claims that. So what they're saying is that all Christianity is anti-Semitic. So if Congress is going to penalize anti-Semitism by following the IHRA definition, it's going to have to pass laws or penalize traditional Christianity teaching, which is the New Testament, of course. That's Christianity. How do you do that? Now, obviously, politically, they're not going to come out and start, you know, burning Bibles. But what they're going to do is, what this law does is, if it's passed, it's a bill, it's not a law yet. If it does, it will create all types of potentially criminal, but more importantly, civil liability or exposure to individuals and institutions who run afoul of Jewish interests. So it just, as a civil rights bill, didn't explicitly say we're going to have affirmative action and endless litigation and accusations of racism. It's going to be used to shake down, operate, you know, companies and intimidate people. It did. It's built in the logic of the law, though. If you read the law, how the law is going to be implemented. So if this law were trying to, were ever enforced or implemented in the law, it would create effectively Jewish supremacism. And basically, they should just call it a Jewish supremacism bill, if you'd be honest about it.
Absolutely. And I think that it will never have any impact on specific legal behavior and jurisprudence, because it's so vaguely written that, I mean, you could just interpret it any way you want. You know, it's just it's just meaningless. But what it does is, of course, is, you know, as you point out, it creates intimidation. They can use it to intimidate corporations, shake them down. They can. But I think the primary reason for it is, you know, is basically a response to the Palestinian protests, but more in the campuses and whatnot in the United States right now. But moreover, it's a reaction to the possibility that the protests on the campuses and the protests against the war could spread to a general revelation and general protesting about Jewish undemocratic power in the United States.
Doesn't this bill prove it? That obviously Congress is beholden to the Jewish lobby.
Well, just self-evident, you know. So
I mean, it's like basically it's the Jews being their own worst enemy in this case.
Right. Well, the thing is, they've kind of had this philosophy, and it's been in place in the United States since, I don't know, 1800 or something. But they've always had this kind of behind the scene power with Freemasonry and been able to manipulate things in the way they wanted them. But I think that they need to get more articulate now because there's finally a reaction against their power. And I think really what this is it's just diminishing returns, because there is no way that the intimidation of the Gentiles relative to the undemocratic situation they find themselves in relative to Judaism is going to become greater. You see what I mean here? There's no way you can get more intimidation with nonsense like this. What this will do, it will create more awareness of the undemocratic power that Jews have in America and in the world. And so I actually think it's wonderful that they would need to go to these ridiculous extremes, because it exposes them. It exposes the need to keep the lid on the mind of the population relative to the tyranny that they are holding everyone within.
Well, yeah, it seemed like dynamic silence was a much better strategy for him.
Yeah, it was. And I think that, but it won't work now because there's just too much awareness. The independent media has exposed too much of it. And people are, the expression, starting to wake up. So this is an attempt to just keep them intimidated and keep them from thinking about these things. It won't work. The college protests are pretty interesting. I mean,
couldn't they just ignore them? I mean, it's here we are in May. Classes end in a week or so.
Right.
And so I understand they're not that large. It's just relative to other protests. Seems like you just ignore it, let it go. But it's almost like they can't help themselves. Just like with how they went overboard with Harvard and Penn State, firing the presidents, Ackman and these other Jewish oligarchs getting out in front saying, we're going to cut off funding. We want this. We want that. And then, exposing the fact that these Jewish donors, in return for their 30 pieces of silver, expect everybody to do their bidding for them.
Dictators become more draconian when they really start being afraid they're going to, lose their power of tyranny. And that's what's going on. I mean, it's everywhere at this point. I mean, people are kind of getting the issue in a general sense. The media won't discuss it. The mainstream media won't discuss it whatsoever. They'll only talk about the intimidation attempts, like the law. But the general public, I would say, has the greatest awareness of the undemocratic Jewish kind of political influence at this moment in the United States and in Europe than they've had, at any time in history.
Yeah. Well, it was 30, I think almost 34 years ago, 1990, 1991, and Pat Buchanan, I think he said it on the McLaughlin Group. I think it was the McLaughlin Group. And he was one of the talking heads. He said that he called it the Congress Israeli occupied territory. And everyone was, was aghast at that. But he was right then. And he's been vindicated with that statement,
Sure.
Events have vindicated him. So anybody who called Pat Buchanan anti-Semite or wrong or ignorant or a buffoon for saying that, he's still alive. He just retired. Send him an apology.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing is, you can, it's hard to attack Buchanan when he's simply stating the facts. And, the truth is always a pretty good platform to stand on, if you know what I mean. And when they attack him, they just have to lie all the more, because the whole reason they were able to create the power, the undemocratic power in the first place, is through camouflage and lies and whatnot.
Whenever you speak the truth, you will be vindicated, whether in this life or posthumously.
Yeah, one way or the other. But you'll also have influence, because the human mind is really designed to be rational. And as long as you just state the facts as you honestly experience them, you just can't go wrong, you know. And so this is the point of this law is to keep the intimidation in place. It's purely a psychological maneuver against the minds of the populace, and it won't work. The intimidation is not going to be, you know, supported or become last longer because they make a law saying you can't think about criticizing, you know.
Well, I mean, was there an uproar or a public uprising or demand for legislation dealing specifically with anti-Semitism prior to October 7th? Or I mean, I just remember last spring,
the population was just
clamoring for it, right?
We had to have it. Where is it to help us? Yeah.
And where is the popular, like you said, even with this bill, that $95 billion giveaway that Mike Johnson signed off on last week, $26 billion going to Israel. Of course, he's a recipient of like $600,000 from AIPAC. In fact, I think the sponsor of this anti-Semitism awareness bill, Lawler, I think from New York, he's a lot of Jewish, I don't think he's Jewish, but he's a lot of Jewish constituents. He received either like $100,000 or $200,000 from AIPAC. So it's obvious, you see, follow the money. You know, this is such a, the bill is Bolshevik. It's a Bolshevist bill. And whenever a country specifically outlaws anti-Semitism, it's a prelude to something worse. Like in Russia with the Bolsheviks, when they outlawed anti-Semitism, it was a prelude to the slaughter of millions of Russians. So tread lightly.
They'll get desperate, and there's no question that they'll try to, you know, they could easily go murderous. But in doing that, I mean, that can work if you have complete control over the media, the narrative, and also the army. You know, I think that they just don't have it's not in place for them to be able to, you know, start, you know, slaughtering.
No, we're not Russia 1917 right now. Yeah.
I just don't see that coming. I think actually they're befuddled. They don't really have a plan at this point that is clear cut. What they're doing is they're just continuing on with what they've been doing for hundreds of years in the hope that they can get to a point where they just have technological, you know, kind of control over the world, and then they can, you know, have what they want. But the rebellion, you know, is taking place.
Well, how can they continue to pose as an oppressed, marginalized, beleaguered, powerless minority group, at the same time be able to have Congress overwhelmingly pander to them?
Right.
It's a bit too much to swallow. If you're,
well, this is the point. This is exactly the point. Well said. They cannot make a coherent argument of their position to the public. If they, you know, these things are like the bill they're passing is just, it's for intimidation. And they can't admit that. They can't say, well, we're just trying to keep you from thinking.
Well, victims don't intimidate.
Right. Because what happens with this kind of stuff now is that people go, well, why are you doing that? What is the point of this? Yes. Jews have a terrific in America. Why do you need to go to these? What are you hiding? What is being hidden becomes revealed with this kind of stupid and you know, just ham-handed effort.
Well, first of all, any Christian who takes their Christianity seriously is going to have to be anti-Semitic based on their definition, because it's criticism of Jews. And if a Christian, particularly Catholics, you're there to baptize all nations, convert all peoples. You can't convert a Jew if it's illegal to criticize.
Right.
That's just a theological point. I'm thinking this is why it's so, I mean, this bill is so vulgar and sweeping. It can't pass constitutional muster, but it does expose a level of control. At the very least, the inclination of our political class to pander to them, pretty much to sell out the country for 30 pieces of silver, you know.
Yeah, and this is, and the thing that is really sickening about this is that this is, the bill is being presented at a moment when Gentiles in Palestine are being genocided. Just flat out genocide.
That's the other thing, is that we're supposed to be worried about a few Jews having their sensibilities bothered on campus. By the way, all the violence against Jews, lies, more violence against protesters, actually, courtesy of the cops, National Guard, and also Jewish, pro-Jewish, pro-Israeli protesters who coming in and cause this not being reported upon. So it's been wildly exaggerated. But at the same time, they're all upset over Jews having to confront criticism, being called names. we're ignoring the slaughter that the U.S. is borrowing money to pay for is outrageous. I mean, it's just are you kidding me? I'm
makes supposed you to be extra stomach to even
Yeah,
and it really it shows how self-centered and racist the Jews who promote this form of intimidation are. They don't have any human empathy for the Palestinians whatsoever. They are literally animals in their mind. They couldn't even function without that producing these kind of psychological intimidation stuff. They couldn't even function if they had any sort of any feeling in their heart at all. They are as cold as stones, and it's just this tragic Deuteronomy kind of control over the Jew, over the lot, many of the Jews' minds, that they just don't see the Gentile as having any value, and that the Gentile can never be wronged, right? He's always the perpetrator of evil, which we have to fight against. It's just they are intellectually debased. They cannot think clearly, and they're very dangerous, so what needs to be done is just more exposure,
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fact.
This is kind of humorous in a way. Kristi Noem, the governor of South Carolina.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry, South Dakota. South Dakota.
Yeah.
She included in a book, I think it was one of these political biographies that politicians have written for them. And she included a tale or a story that she put down, shot a rambunctious puppy. It was a hunting dog, apparently slightly more than a year old, which does, if I understand, does still make it a puppy. It's very young. These dogs need to be trained to do it properly. It wasn't being trained properly. That's what I'm reading about. I know nothing about dog training, so with that caveat. But nevertheless, it's, what was funny is that she thinks that it would look good in a book. It might be a fact this is a woman trying to appear tough, to make the hard decisions, if you will. The knee-jerk reaction is, well, you don't know what it's like to be on a farm, rural life. Sometimes you have to kill a dog. I mean, that sort of thing. We've all seen Old Yeller and Atticus Finch shoot the rabid dog and To Kill a Mockingbird, that sort of thing. And so, but this seems to be something different. Now, some people say what happened was this story had been floating around South Dakota for a while. She was getting ahead of it by putting in the book. Nevertheless, it is a little humorous. It kind of reminds me of a situation, General Patton, World War II, when he slapped a soldier.
Yeah.
And for having, I guess, being nervous in battle, having shell shock. And he slapped him and said, I don't have cowards with these wounded soldiers. And of course, he's reprimanded for that. When he did that, and the story got home, the public and the Congress started raised. They wanted him relieved of his command, even though he was probably the most effective general the U.S. Army had at the time. Now, again, it is kind of funny at the time. And then someone told him, I don't know if this is true, but it was in the movie Patton. And another general told him, I think it was Omar Bradley. I might be wrong, but I think it was Omar Bradley, played by Carl Malden in the movie. He goes, you can send some kid to go off and die in some godforsaken rock across the world, but you can't slap him. Now, you say this, you can sign legislation. This is like Kristi Noem. So you can sign legislation effectively nullifying the First Amendment's guaranteed right to free speech, just to pander to the Jewish lobby and support the slaughter of tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians by Israel, but you can't shoot a dog because it really bothers people.
I mean, this is just the strangest thing. She, I guess, is trying to present herself, at least, as the narrative comes to us, that even though she's a woman, she has the ability to make the tough decision.
Yes.
But the problem is, it wasn't like she was, saving, a group of children from a rabid dog.
No,
the dog is this lovable, kind of mischievous puppy that won't really, permit itself to be trained to do exactly what it's supposed to do when it's hunting. And the real crime is that the dog was not attended, was let loose and killed a bunch of chickens.
Yes.
And this is the final straw. Well, I mean, everyone would root for the dog in this story. And so if this was an attempt at political promotion, it was just the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
It only makes her seem either really stupid or really heartless or both. So you have to wonder about, well, doesn't she have, I mean, I don't know what kind of level of political sophistication exists in South Dakota, God only knows, but doesn't she have anyone giving her advice about these things to say, well, you know, the, you know, kill like mischievous dog cohort is really not very large in the United States. So maybe we have no reason to do them. You know, a lot of people like dogs. So, I mean, it just was stupid and it made no sense to me. And if she is actually going to be the vice president candidate, it's a very bad omen, you know, for Trump. I just found the whole thing, if it's real, because you have to wonder about, you know, is there some kind of...
Well, Hillary Clinton reposted a tweet, don't vote for anyone you can't, wouldn't trust with your dog. It's still true. She posted that in 2021. So she just reposted, it's still true. Well, at least Christina, from what I understand, hasn't had any person's shot.
Right.
I don't think Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton. I mean, that's just absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, Hillary Clinton, you can celebrate the brutalization and murder of a foreign leader like Gaddafi and foment a civil war in a country that results in the deaths of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, creates a migration crisis of millions into Europe, but you can't shoot a dog.
Yeah, I mean, I think Christie should go back to Hillary saying, you know, at least I just shot him cleanly. I didn't, torture him with anal rape and then parade him around town and tied on to the hood of a car. I mean, your murders are a lot more, grotesque, and you have no one, you don't have any right to be criticizing mine. But, I mean, this is diminishing returns because I don't think it's an issue you can really wade into and hope to win, even if, you know, your opponent is Hillary Clinton, just because it's just her behavior was really stupid. And the way she described the creature, the dog, was, it's just going to, this will come back to haunt her, I'm sure. It'll become like one of the main campaign issues. if she's actually made the vice president candidate. So
Mitt Romney have a story about a dog where he put a dog on top of their car in a cage and drove around outside in the winter or something on a family trip?
I seem to remember something about that. I mean,
it's some weird story.
I would think most of the, you know, kind of mainstream politicians that we see are basically psychopaths. I mean,
so honestly, if loving dogs is a prerequisite for being a likable politician, then Adolf Hitler, right? He liked dogs.
Sure, he loved dogs. Never shot a dog, as far as I know.
Never shot a dog, from what I understand. Yeah. Although I think he did give it, at least according to the official story, he poisoned it in the bunker.
Oh, did he? Yeah, well, but
he poisoned Blondie. He didn't want the Russians getting him. imagine what the Russians would have done to that poor German Shepherd. I think it was an Alsatian. Yeah, maybe that's the same. Alsatian. Blondie was an Alsatian, which is kind of like a German Shepherd. What else? Oh yeah, your estate. I thought massive layoffs in fast food and retail. Why is that?
It's because they've made the minimum wage $20 an hour, and
you've gotten a rage. Bad news is I have to fire you now.
Yeah, and then there's so many restrictions of where you really can't have someone apply for a job and then not hire them. Because literally everything that would be rational about excluding someone has been prohibited. I mean, if he has a prior criminal record, that can't be part of the decision process. Obviously, race is just monstrous. You know, if the person has any kind of claim to be from protected, you know, ethnicity, that's just leaves it impossible to. So hiring in retail and in California is very difficult right now. Now the good news for our government is there are not going to be many violators of this because the street retail in California is absolutely disappearing. You know, with the incarceration and with the transition to an online, Amazon-based, economic world, All of the premier streets in like Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, are really pretty much empty at this point. Where I live, our main commercial street, which is a little tiny street, that just one street, but it has, gosh, an incredible number of blank spaces. And of course, San Francisco is just famous now for having no retail left, in large sections
I
of it.
find it interesting that retail stores would be taxed over the years to pay for things like the well, development of the internet, not to mention development taxing to pay for the roads.
Yeah.
I mean,
I mean,
companies like Amazon don't pay their fair share of taxes for the amount of road damage they do with their trucks.
of course. I mean, anyway, but it's like the timing is important to understand, in that no rational supporter of California's economy would choose this moment to insert like a $20 an hour minimum wage,
Well, it's not
because,
a, you're not addressing the core problem, economic
well,
problems of
also
California.
it's just, this is a crisis of a lack of retail businesses going extinct, and now you would throw this in. So what I think is the honest, way of understanding this is just, this is just a another attempt to accelerate the Amazonation, to use an expression, of our world, because retail, is where cash can be used. It's where culture can be, common human culture can be sustained, and
Yeah, there's real that's genuine intercourse, if you will.
whereas the Amazon world that they have in mind, it's all monitored electronically, and you just sit in your house until you evaporate, and they will bring you food from time to time. It's
If
really,
you're good, if you're good, because if you say the wrong thing,
because they're
they
social.
might close your Amazon Prime account.
Well, exactly. So this is, what they are doing, and this is just accelerating it by making it.
Well, how about, I mean, how do you mandate higher wages at the same time you bring flooded the state or the country with illegal immigration?
Well, it's just impossible and contradictory. So again, it goes to my position in terms of how to think about the world. Since we don't know anything about the reality, I mean, of what these people are like, they just lie their heads off. The only thing you can do is try to create a framework that's at least coherent. And so when you look at the idea of a $20 minimum wage in California, when you have hordes of unskilled immigrants being led across the border, when retail is collapsing, the only real, explanation is that this is a deliberate attempt to get rid of retail in a, in the Main Street sense of it, and to replace it completely with Amazon. That's what's really going on. And I mean, there's no other, I mean, how else would you explain, the combination of all these things, of letting
Well,
in the
if you're
immigrants?
going to, I understand the idea of the living wage, wages high enough that people can have a family, particularly a man can raise a fa raise or support a family, because that's not really on the agenda now. In fact, it's quite the opposite. But when you have, general policies, when you have one sort of a macroeconomic environment of constant monetary depreciation, which leads to what? Well, one thing, deindustrialization, monetary devaluation, which makes it harder and harder to. Because the purchasing power of your wages is constantly going down because of government fiscal policy, debt, borrowing. Good example, borrowing $95 billion on top of a $35 trillion national debt to just give away abroad to promote wars, civil wars, and slaughter, and whatever corruption and mischief. These things over the years have a cumulative effect. This is why the standard of living and the quality of life is declining in the United States, at the same time flooding the country with all with well, pretty much making Emma Lazarus's
Because
poem law.
you can make, and if the currency debases, then this, look at Weimar. I mean, think about of a living wage in the 1950s. Here you had a living wage because, an ordinary man with an ordinary job could afford a house, a wife, and raise his children, right? This is a living wage by definition. Now that, so in order to create that, a living wage, you need to go back to what was going on in 1950. You see, And this was when, you know, you had, there wasn't the currency debasement. So if people are really interested in the living wage, what they have to do is they have to go to the government and say, stop the fiat currency creation of just eternal new debt. Because when you're doing this, all this, it makes it impossible for a living wage to ever be a solid, real thing. It's always going to be a moving target. So you'd have to go and say, you know, we're not going to have this situation where the government creates debt, the bank then creates the credit to buy the debt out of thin air, and then arbitrages the difference between what the government pays and what it pays itself to suddenly magically create a 1 or 2%, you know, a profit for all of the primary banks with the creation of government debt. It's all of the money then is being focused more and more into a narrow group of individuals, and the currency itself is just constantly a moving target, moving down. You know, so this will probably, you know, they've talked about this. Certainly in 08, it became a, you know, kind of a major issue. It's gone away, but it will return. And at some point, the dollar will simply collapse and be replaced by something. And until then, there will never be a living wage, as the expression is defined, because the currency is just going to be collapsing too quickly.
You know, you have to wipe away the debt. So there's like usually like a 75-80 year cycle. And you've seen that crisis in the West ever since the creation of the Bank of England in 1690.
Yeah, and then they come up with a new currency to get rid of the debt.
Well, you have what, 1690 Bank of England, then you have the crisis in the colonies roughly 75 years later, the American Revolution, then roughly 75 years later, you have another crisis in the United States. This is creates the American Civil War. Then you have World War I, World War II, you have the Great Depression, of course, which facilitates the Second World War. So it goes back to monetary, monetary shenanigans.
Oh, from Brett.
What about by usury?
Yeah, when they got off the gold system and they had the ability then to, create just unlimited dollars.
That's when wages stagnated and the credit card was issued.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you very much.
And so now to fix the problem, you're going to create a $20 minimum wage. It's just, it's pathetic. And
then they unleash feminism on people.
Yeah.
To double the workforce, lower wages even further, put more pressure on that. And that, so basically to mandate high wages and don't address like fiscal policy, monetary policy, these matters. It's like you're just trying to, I guess feel good legislation doesn't address the problem because ultimately speaks to productivity and the idea of the money you earn maintaining its value so you can buy what you need and save a little bit. But that creates an economy, distributist, fair, sort of a spread the wealth, share the wealth economy as opposed to a user system, which inexorably leads to wealth concentration and control, which we have today.
Exactly. And see, these are the things that have to be addressed is wealth concentration and currency debasement because of government overspending and invention of fake money. That is not, of course, even being discussed. Right?
No, because you talk about the problem of wealth concentration, everyone calls you a communist.
Or an anti-Semite.
Well, aren't you? You're just dog whistling.
Bankers
and user, you're dog whistling.
Yeah.
It's like, well, if like I said, our system of checks and balances, it was designed that way because of the idea, the theory is you divide political power and through the competition of various factions, you maintain liberty. Well, okay, that's theoretical. But at the same time, it should also apply to wealth. The economic system, which results in a vast concentration of wealth in a few hands, inevitably that power, because if you live in a society where dollar is king or money matters, that power is going to be arbitraged or leveraged rather into political power and cultural power. We see that today, and so that's a reality, and so we have to deal with that political reality to address the problem. And increasing the wage from $16 to $20 an hour isn't going to address that problem.
No.
Not in California, not anywhere. So, but we did kind of touch on, allude to it, is this idea of debt and feminism and the sort of how it contributed to the war of the sexes that was unleashed in the 1960s. with sexual liberation, women's liberation, feminism. Of course, inevitably, there's going to, if you believe in Hegel, Hegelian dialectic, there's going to be a dialectic, there's going to be a reaction to it. And what we have recently, we've seen, it's the manosphere, the so-called red pill. Now, the red pill is the idea that you take the pill and you wake up to the reality of the system, as opposed to the blue pill, where you just accept what you're being told and you're just a cog in the machine and you're not going to question anything. The red pill is, you take the red pill, it's from the movie The Matrix, and you see the reality for what it is, and you go from there. And the red pill has been sort of applied to the relationship between the sexes, men and women, and how men are waking up to what the reality is from their position in current society. The idea that men still harbor or hold most of the responsibility for productivity, earning, and these things, but they have no power, no privileges or authority to go with that responsibility, which doesn't make much sense to them. And nor is there much to be had in the dating world, much less the getting married, because of the state of family courts or family law is there to emasculate men, deny them any authority, deny them any power, and of course to supposedly to empower women. Of course, that's not what it does really, because by emasculating men, they actually leave women to be enslaved. That's one of the tricks of feminism. But we have this sort of red pill, and I think the red pill itself is a reaction to the collapse of patriarchy, which is a natural state, meaning that men are designed or are created to sort of lead, and women are there to support, and men provide that leadership that, and of course, Christianity calls it servant leadership, meaning it's a responsibility to protect and to provide, and with that responsibility comes the authority. And with that authority comes admiration and respect of women. And from that becomes men. Women are attracted to men, and then you have babies. And if you deny them the authority, they can no longer be admired and respected. And if they're thought of as just being equal, even less, women no longer admire them, and they no longer find most men attractive or interesting, then you don't have babies, which is why you have the birth dearth in the West, because we've had 60 years of feminist claptrap imposed upon us by our elites, particularly by a certain group, which they always seem to come up in these conversations. That's kind of it in a nutshell. That's kind of a crude, I think, a description. I think it's generally accurate, because it basically, by just shattering the polarity between male and female, they've made male and female not interested in one another, not as interested in one another as they once were. And as they've also destroyed institutions and customs and these things that supported that outlook, all in the name of liberation and equality, when no one needs to be liberated and equality doesn't really exist. What exists between men and women is a complementary relationship. And so to say they should be equal is to deny them the reality of the complementary relationships, which then it makes the relationship between men and women dysfunctional. I know this is abhorrent to the ears of feminism or those who believe in equality and the presumptions that women are best are the most happy, and women can only judge themselves by the standards by which we judge men, which is what feminism does. At the same time, it derogates and assaults all things feminine, the most important of which is like having children, which is pretty important. If you don't have that, then your society goes away. And what have you? So whatever ideology you entertain, whatever system you support, if it doesn't support the propagation of the family and the procreation of children, it's a system that isn't worth the paper it's written on, and should not be entertained or implemented in the policy. So that's kind of so. What's your take on all this?
Well, I take the position that feminism was part of an attack that is really outlined in the authoritarian personality, which is to say the family is a bad idea, right? So with feminism, you get the idea that the role that women had historically had inside the family was inferior. And this actually is also found in Marx. You know, Marx in Das Kapital, he talks about this, that being a mother is basically a form of property.
Didn't he treat his wife horribly?
Oh yeah, it's just okay. Sexist pig. But anyway, so the thing is, when I've done I think one podcast with the MGTOW people, and I said, you know,
men going their own way.
And see, there's various components of the manosphere. It's not just one thing. You know, you also have the pickup artists, you know, and there's father rights groups and things. So it's a broad spectrum of reactions against.
Yeah, they call it the game. It's where you exploit female psychology. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I kind of criticized the Mansphere, and I said, look, you're missing the nature of the attack. The attack was to destroy the family, and in doing to try to do that, they produce feminism with the idea that a woman's role is inferior inside a family. And I said the response to the attack is to try to simply have a family. And I think that in the rhetoric that I was getting from those guys in the discussion and from like the PUA guys, the pickup artists, you know, and stuff, what I was hearing is that they really weren't trying to change society back to, you know, a family-based structure. What they really wanted to do was to fight back and to defend themselves and to be victorious in this new post-family world. And I just thought that this was, you know, kind of the wrong direction to head into. I think that rather than like something like the Manosphere, which even the name of it, you know, is sort of post-family, right? I mean, you have this, they're trying to take on the same position of isolation that the feminists have. I would have the same criticism of the term feminism because it is contradictory to really how humans exist in their healthiest state, which is within a family. Mm-hmm. And so you don't really need feminism and you don't need, you know, extreme sort of authority to either sex, right? What you have are roles. Mm-hmm. And as you talked about the man having authority in his role, but the woman would have authority in terms of the world of children. I mean, women are just much better at, certainly at having children.
They call it mother's tongue.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so this
and the idea, mother's tongue,
So the idea that the family is a bad thing. You see, they attack a component of it and then try to, you know, get women to be transformed into seeing the family as a bad idea.
Well, I think what they did, they got women the weak point. They said they attacked the idea of obedience. And you see obedience as subservient to weak. Right. No, obedience is not subservient to weak if it's to proper authority.
Well, I mean, the thing is, look, the woman has the need, particularly when she's, you know, in the year of childbirth, year and a half of that whole process.
Yes.
The man has a responsibility to provide. So the woman has an authority to, you know, insist upon the male leaving up to providing his role, right?
Because otherwise, who's exploiting whom here?
Who's exploiting whom? But you see, it's so
it's both. Like, there is this. I'm sorry. Funny thing was there is a movie that came out or a TV show called 1970s. It's called Planet Earth. It's supposed to be about a dystopian post-apocalyptic society, and there's a community of scientists who inhabit the city that's trying to create a renaissance in learning in this post-apocalyptic society, and their job is to go out and sort of evangelize, you know, downtrodden or now, you know, beleaguered humanity, you know, the virtues of enlightened science. It's very 70s, that sort of thing. It's with the actor John Saxon, I think, it's supposed to be a 70s thing. And there's a pilot episode, they run into a society or a village that's run by women and they enslave men. They use them for work and sex. And and they describe society. They go, a society where men are forced to work to provide for women. I go, wait a second. Like, this isn't some dystopian fantasy in the future. It's kind of always been.
this is just part of critical theory. It's just what happened with feminism and, you know, is just another component of critical theory where everything which is structurally important for European culture and Christian culture is attacked. And there's always some side of it which can be, you know, given as, well, look, if this is wrong, it violates this other principle. And so, you know, women, because they wouldn't have the same authority as the breadwinner in some parts of the family structure, then therefore the family is bad. But this is just sophistry. I mean, the family requires different roles. You have to have different roles with our biology, otherwise you have no family. So the family couldn't be defended any more than the general culture could be, because the media was in the hands of people who wanted to break the family apart. And the real part of which doesn't get mentioned by the manosphere guys often is pornography. Mm-hmm. Because, like, whereas you know, the idea of you know, you have to be the breadwinner to be an equal person was given to the woman, pornography was given to the male as, well, this is what sex should be like.
Yeah, being a playboy rather than being a father. Yeah.
Pickup artist, right? Exactly. Yeah. That they separate out these issues from it and say, look at the sex you could be having if you were free of this whole family stuff.
Well, it turns out that only a few men are having a lot of sex. So there you go.
Well, of course. I mean, the thing is just, like, how many feminists are happy with their power in the workplace, you know? So the whole, all of this stuff is non-biological, because the honest and only biological reality is just the family has to be supported. We have roles within it. And if we are not inside a family and we are not in our role within the family, our life is diminished. The critical theorists can say whatever they want, but that's just, that is just nature.
Well, the way they've structured the economy and the laws and over the past 50, 60 years, we now have generations of women who are addicted to box wine and Xanax. Sure. The good news is feminism has narrowed the pay gap. So these unhappy and erotic gals can now afford the booze and pills that they consume. So
feminism hasn't been this unpopular in statistical polls in campus since like the 1950s. I mean, it's literally now visible to women that they really would have been, they will be happier than in a family than they will be in a workplace, in a world of isolation where they get a gold watch at the end of their tenure of being a middle level manager or something, you know, and the power that they were supposed to be experiencing, which was going to be meaningful because they had authority in the workplace, it turns out to be absolutely hollow.
Well, one thing about the red pill is, and this is feminism, they both embrace sexual liberation or sexual morality as a lifestyle.
Yeah.
I mean, nihilism. They're saying, well, the rules are shattered. Nihilism.
Yeah, and with male being so vulnerable to pornography, which I describe as a black hole in which all civilization can be sucked in and destroyed, they end up defending their sexual position, and this is when it really has gone off the rails.
Because with men it's pornography, with women it's pride.
Right, but once you get to the point where you're defending the structure that was created to attack the family, mm-hmm. once you've gone that far away from kind of like the biological reality, you're really just in a world of meaninglessness, and it's hard to come back to the real world, because just like it's very difficult for men after they've become pornographically addicted to go back to a relationship with a real woman, same thing is true for a woman who's become, you know, who's given a taste of success and
the boss girl. Yeah,
I mean, they just,
well, she's very few, because women are hypergamous by nature. So if they do it, are given this success or status outside the home, they're going to find very few men that satisfy them, because they have to marry.
Right. And where does this lead? I mean, you see, the worker's paradise part of it was in the 70s with Gloria Steinem and all this.
Yeah.
You could make the case then and not be laughed out of the room, because there was no evidence of what it would lead to. But now
the damage wasn't clear yet. Yeah.
Yeah. Now the isolated woman in her 50s and 60s with no family, what kind of a role does she have? I mean, you know, there's only so many like feminist drum circles you can attend.
Well, Gloria Steinem, she's the one that said that a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's real.
Well, here's the point. And I've made this point several times to my daughters, is if you look around you, one of the things about feminism, it's facilitated by the infrastructure, the consumer goods, the technology, the innovations, the luxuries that men, for the most part, have provided. They're the ones that the innovative, provide the innovation, the production, the work, the value-added labor. Over 90% of the value-added labor in our economy, emphasis value-added, is provided by male labor, men working, men at work. Everything you look around you, the houses, the buildings, the roads, the cars, the little devices, have been developed and improved by men. The raw materials that are harvested and shipped, with the possible exception of the clothes you wear, where it's factories in Bangladesh or Vietnam, women working in factories and these things. Women have always worked the looms, though. That's nothing new. My point is that if you look at it, if you look at the war between the sexes, it's enabled by an incredible sense of entitlement and a taking for granted by women about what's provided for them. And here my point is, and it isn't some point of me pounding my chest saying, look, me, man, me, superior, because collectively we do all the work. It's an acknowledgement of the role we play. Now, of course, given the fact that men, if you look at electricians, construction work, real work, extraction, 98% male. The shipping, all that, 98% male, everything. Men provided for women. Now, because we live in a very complex global economy, high scale division of labor, we tend to look at it as socialized, meaning these things roll off the assembly lines and end up on our front door and in the shelves in the store. We just take that for granted. We don't see the incredible amount of organization labor that creates. And again, most of that labor is using devices and machines that are created by men. So men doing all the work, all the value-added work. That being the case, I ask women, what do you provide? What do you provide? Well, the answer would be what?
Well, the answer would be you provide. Say, The children who
but that's pretty darn important, isn't it? Yeah, is that pretty darn important?
Of course. I mean, the children are as important as, so as
the reason why I'm mentioning this is
as the widgets and the electrical
it's very
work.
But it's complimentary. So this is
exactly
all this work, all this stuff. Men do dumb things like get in their rickety wooden boats and explore the world. They do dumb things just to get women. But yeah. So this is how it works. Here's my point though is we live in a society which obscures this, takes all these things for granted. This has allowed, because we also live in a, let's go back to our discussion about the structure of our economy, the macroeconomic environment, particularly the deindustrialized economy where production, extraction, these things are no longer, now it's all paper pushing, bureaucratic, law, education. That's the type of make work jobs that women can do and earn as much or more as men. So it's built on an illusion. It's built on a debt-based illusion. If you return to a more production-based society, society would favor male labor more again. Now, what this does is this illusion of equality breeds contempt by women generally towards men, meaning they don't need men. I'm a strong. We don't need men anymore to provide. And we hear, often say again, you don't need each other because they earn. Well, why do they earn this as much? We look at the structure of our economy. It's all based on debt and it's all distorted. My point is. Is if you just take a step back and look at the real productivity, the things that we consume our high standard of living is based on, our survival is based on, our physical survival is provided by male labor. And you extract it from the economy, 98% of the economy goes away. And then what do you have? Nothing. You're back, living not even a subsistence level in the jungle somewhere. Oh. My point being is, what do women owe men? The thing is, if women acknowledge collectively the role that men play in providing for them, that will spark respect and admiration for them, which will then spark attraction to them. It's the feminism thing. It says we're all equal. Well, promise, if you make everyone equal, women will naturally lose interest in men. Men, women, generally speaking, if they have to have something to admire in a man. You've seen this. I was talking to a lady recently and I didn't say anything. I just let her talk. And we were talking about relationships. And she said, what's important in a relationship is that both men and the husband and the wife see themselves as equal partners. And that's what most women are looking for. By the way, woman was divorced.
Of course. And you
see,
it's all just very clever sophistry to bring about the destruction of the family. The idea of equal partners. Look, equal partners, meaning neither one of them are doing the role that they're supposed to be doing.
Yes.
They have made the family evil with these definitions, right? Because the family, for it to function, you need acceptance and also enjoyment and pride in fulfilling your role within the structure. right? Yes. The woman needs to think that me having children and producing the next generation by raising them properly is actually not something that is possible to not occur and have a, you know, a real functioning world. And the male has to think, you know, I'm out there, you know, doing this work, and this has a tremendous benefit for the family's cohesion and, you know, and like the ability to raise the children. So both roles have to be seen as valuable. And when you say, well, we need to change, not have roles and have this equality, what you've done is simply very cleverly attack the family itself. They in the sophistry, the anti-family sophistry, Tim, if you go through like Gloria Steinem and stuff, they never talk about the family as something, they're very seldom as something that is bad, because it's just a stupid, unbiological reality, an argument that no one would pay attention to. But they attack these individual elements of things inside the family to break it up without the people knowing.
Well, they talk about sex, and the last thing they talk about is babies.
Yeah.
They'll talk endless about sex, but they don't talk about babies.
Yeah. What?
I'm not sure this is true, but I've read that in Alfred Kinsey's 1953 work, Sexual Behavior in the Human Female, I think it's close to 900 pages long, there's not one single reference to motherhood in that book. Does sexuality factor in the motherhood at all?
It was the guy was just as we've discussed, he was just complete degenerate.
Okay, yeah, he was a homosexual. And I'm thinking, and this is the expert?
Yeah.
That's promoted by Time Life?
Yeah. So, right, there you go. There's the bona fide. So yeah. it was all just a designed attack, part of critical theory to break apart European culture, every bit of it. And women now are sadly realizing the loneliness that this approach produces, and men are realizing that, you know, being a pickup artist in your 50s is really not much of a life.
No, it's not. And what we've done is we've created how many women have to work now or do work. And the traditional idea was women didn't work when they got married, and it was good because they were establishing the home. But there is a problem with the workplace with women, and it has a coarsening effect. Not only does it invite temptation, it creates a sense that your accomplishment, basically acknowledgement or of your accomplishments or appreciation is done, there's an external, your boss, your company, and that competes with the husband. So that no surprise that of women have gone to work more, infidelity has skyrocketed, and so is divorce. I think more than 2/3 of all divorces in the United States are initiated by women. And this is the fact it has a coarsening effect, and this is this basically creates a kind of low grade sexual dysphoria in them. And that if they're competitive in these things, now everyone's, you know, that all this is very much encouraged. Be competitive, go and do this. But if you do that, you're not going to be able to play a very important supportive role. Again, this requires everyone putting aside their pride and acknowledging reality and nature to these. There's a nature to these things. There's a logos and nature to sex and how men and women relate to one another.
Yeah,
individually, there's always been room for individuals, people, exceptions that prove the rule, if you will. But by and large, we've had 60 years of derogating and devouring motherhood. The idea of being an obedient wife has been joked at. But people say, man up. If you're a father, man up. Live up to your responsibilities. You know, don't stop complaining. Well, it goes the other way then. Problem is, and that's the point, is if a woman is there to provide hearth and home and she's not at home, then you don't have a hearth and home and you don't have family, which is the objective.
Of course.
Which
of course.
Is the objective.
You know, what I told the men going their own way guys was that they should rethink their, kind of their approach and structure their, intellectual kind of world on the idea of what can I do to create a family? Because all of them were single. And so the group that I was talking to, they're all single. And they didn't really have optimism about having a family. And there were a lot of really good reasons. And some of them weren't very wealthy, you know, and they had all the ability to produce a family was daunting to them. But I said, look, this is just life. You know, there's problems with life. You have to overcome them, but have the goal. of creating a family, have the goal of fatherhood, have the goal of having a relationship with a woman who is inside a family and is supported and has value in part as part of the family, as you would being a father and a supporter. I said, this is to go in the route that these guys were doing, to create kind of a vocabulary and support of one another in their isolation. I said, this is really, you know, this is basically accepting defeat, because, you know, you have been attacked. And you need to find ways to try to fight back. You don't need ways to accept.
Yeah, getting together in a cave and bashing women isn't a solution, right?
Yeah. And to accept a life without being, you know, a father is.
I think there's a difference between joking about. You know, we can all laugh at each other. We sure. And one thing that feminism does is it denies. It doesn't accept. Feminists don't have a sense of humor about themselves. They take themselves far too seriously. You know, which is, again, is I guess men have a greater capacity to laugh, at least in my experience, to laugh at themselves. Maybe it speaks to greater security. I don't know, insecurity or but no, the idea is, one of the advice now, the red pill guys, the manosphere, I do see some, because a lot of half truths and some solid advice. One with solid advice would be is, don't chase women, chase success, chase achievement. If you, in that pursuit of success and achievement, you will attract women.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that that's going to take them to the right place, though, because...
No, my point is that men have to achieve something.
Well, they have to have the ability...
They have to provide, right?
They have to have the ability to function inside a family as a man.
So if they educate themselves, get serious, learn skill, be competent, this is all good advice.
Absolutely.
They're going to be more attractive. Women, I hate that. Women out there, says men don't care about your accomplishments. They don't care about your sports, you know, your scholarships or your achievements. They're interested in you basically initially as a beauty object, because you're something you're attractive, and as a mother, as a woman, and that is the potential for children. That's something that nature bestows upon them, and if they follow that right, they will do it right. It's not something they have to go out, create, and accomplish. Men are faced with the burden of having to create, put a dent in the universe, if you will, make a difference. Yeah.
So the you know the men going their own ways and the pickup artists, they really need to rethink their strategy here and not accept the defeat of like the isolation and then the way, you know, they can go through life successfully, so to speak, you know, in a feminist world. They need to go out and find the women who are capable of being mothers. That's what they need to do.
Yes. Yeah.
That's what they need to find. Just like women who are capable of being mothers and fitting in a family, they need to go out and find males who can function as fathers. And so the culture works 180 degrees opposed to this. We will always be swimming upstream because pornography will be there, feminism will be there, all of these elements, you know, that are pulling against the family creation are going to be there. You just have to be strong. I mean, somehow it can be done. Like I had a discussion with a father of two daughters, and he was sending them to the school. They're both coming into high school age. And he said the school, 30% of them in a survey, it's like a high class sort of, you know, oligarchic type school, prep school. He said in a study, he goes, 30% of them were either gay or non-binary. And I said, if you send your daughters into such an institution, you're basically giving them a death sentence. Mm-hmm. I said, there's 30% that have been sterilized already, just ideologically, you know, by the position they have sexually. But think of the rest of the school. What fraction of the women who don't identify as non-binary are feminists, right? And I said, look, that school will have a reproductive rate going forward of zero. You're not going to get any family production out of that, of these people. If 30% are non-binary and gay, the rest are so damaged that there isn't going to be any family production. You put your daughter into that mess, you think it's an elite prep school and somehow things are going to get good, she will come out a feminist or a lesbian, and there will never be a real life for this child, because there will not be a real family she can fit into. Mm-hmm. I said, you gotta find some other place to send the kid. I was really kind of belligerent, wouldn't let him off the hook, because I felt strongly about this. I just said, no, you've got to rethink this. This is not where you put children.
Ever. No, because I mean, if you leave these things up to the good judgment of young women, it's not going to work, because by virtue of their youth, they don't have good judgment.
You have to have an overall kind of containment culture. That's why the only schools really, like in our area, are the Catholic schools. Up until
the mid to late 60s, the overall emergent behavior, and there's institutional support for a normal life. That changed in the late 60s and 70s. Exactly. Even in the 70s, it was there. I mean, obviously, it was there. I mean, going back to 53 and Kinsey, right? That sort of thing. But really kicked in the 70s and 80s, and it's had this cumulative. Each successive generation is more dysfunctional than the next, because each is victimized by
birth rate is sinking through the floor.
Yeah,
family production is like really, you know, being dramatically reduced, and the goal of the oligarchs is being achieved. Mm-hmm. This was always designed to genocide and exterminate European culture. Always. It's what it was. It was hidden. They didn't announce what it was. And many of the people who were involved in the implementation of the plan didn't even know what they were doing. But this was what it was about. The people who created the authoritarian personality or promoted Kinsey, they knew what it would lead to. They knew it would lead to a sterilized culture.
It's the foundation of society. So if you destroy the foundation of society, society's going to collapse. That's what the family, you know,
for sure.
The family for that. So, okay, Joe, how about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, interesting discussion, brother. And yep. We'll get them next week. Thank you.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.